Welcome to session 153, Visions in the Nighttime. We will first hear from our presenter, Lisa Hansen. Lisa wonders what she's going to be when she grows up. She is musical director for Payson, Utah's Youth Theater, accompanies the Payson Civic Chorale, moonlights by day as a full-time legal secretary, teaches classes in relaxation and altered states, and would like to practice hypnotherapy full-time. She and her husband, Bill, have 7 children. She enters an altered state daily, just about dinner time. And following Lisa's presentation, we will hear from Les Gripke. Les lives in Boulder Creek, California. He works as a counselor in a group home for mentally ill adults and is a certified hypnotherapist. He's also a member of the United Methodist Church, and he considers his journeys within the Mormon and Quaker traditions to be an important part of his spiritual life. And following each of their presentations, hopefully there will be time for questions and answers. And when we get to that point, please do use the IO microphone. Thank you.
One of the exciting things about this topic is that when people find out I'm speaking on this topic, they start sharing with me some of the experiences that they've had, and I've just been able to absorb so many interesting things. This is a topic that, if you have interest in it, generally fascinates you. And it shall come to pass in the last day, saith God, I will pour out of my spirit upon all flesh, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, and your young men shall see visions, and your old men shall dream dreams. And on my servants and my handmaidens I will pour out in those days of my spirit, and they shall prophesy. One of the interesting scriptures that has to do with altered states. One important legacy of our Mormon spiritual heritage is that we are encouraged to receive enrichment directly from divine sources. Our lesson manuals, our monthly magazines, our visiting teaching messages proclaim the gospel principle of personal revelation. Even general church authorities of the modern era, who may not be particularly known for their indulgence of personal individual variation of belief, have been clear and outspoken about the right of each member to receive a direct conduit of divine knowledge. The experience of receiving such personal revelation is often referred to as the still small voice. If we claim we are listening to the still small voice, we are claiming an experience that is not fully sensory or limited to the senses that we have. It also implies an altered state. Scriptural revelations are often connected with a dream or trance state. For example, in Matthew, when Joseph was told about Mary, that's the situation where this happened. When the angel of the Lord appeared to him, it was in a dream. And what Peter reports, that he went up on the housetop to pray about the 6th hour, and he became very hungry and would have eaten. But while they made ready, the words in the King James Version are, he fell into a trance and saw heaven opened. And Paul reports, when I was come up again to Jerusalem, even while I prayed in the temple, this is Paul, I was in a trance and saw the Lord speaking to me. At another time, Paul records, I will come to visions and revelations of the Lord. I knew a man in Christ, which we understand to be Paul himself, whether in the body or not, I cannot tell, only God knoweth. He reports about being caught up into paradise and hearing unspeakable words. In the Book of Mormon, Nephi records that his father Lehi returned to his house in Jerusalem, cast himself upon his bed, and being overcome with the Spirit was carried away in a vision. And later, Nephi records, Lehi hath written many things which he saw in visions and dreams. The Lord's instruction for Lehi to leave Jerusalem was given in a dream. The instruction for Nephi and his brothers to return to Jerusalem was given in a dream. Lehi's sublimest teaching, the vision of the tree of life, was given with the words, I have dreamed a dream. Latter-day Revelation confirms the association of altered states with the receipt of revelation. Joseph Smith records, the heavens were opened upon us, and I beheld the celestial kingdom of God and the glory thereof, whether in the body or out, I cannot tell. Brigham Young related dreams of instruction from Joseph Smith as revelation to him, and Wilford Woodruff gave an entire discourse on the value of dreams in receiving revelation. I'm going to read you a portion of what Wilford Woodruff's discourse is here. He said, the Lord has many ways in which he communicates with us. Frequently, as has been the case in every age, truths, principles, and warnings are communicated to the children of men by means of dreams and visions. But we have a great many dreams. I have in my life, he said, and I suppose you have, more or less, which amount to nothing. I will tell you just about what I refer to. A man eats a hot supper when he goes to bed. He gets a nightmare. He is chased by a bear, or he falls over a precipice, and as soon as he strikes the ground, he wakes up. Now the Lord had nothing to do with that. A man may go to bed half worried to death, tired, and dream about something that will never take place. Last night, Wilford Woodruff continues, for instance, I dreamt I was making glass houses out of blocks of glass 2 feet square. I don't know that the Lord was in that. Yet I have had dreams of a very different character. When I was a boy 11 years old, I had a very interesting dream, part of which was fulfilled to the very letter. In this dream, I saw a great gulf, a place where all the world had to enter at death, before doing which they had to drop their worldly goods. I saw an aged man with a beaver hat and a broadcloth suit. The man looked very sorrowful. I saw him come with something on his back, which he had to drop among the general pile before he could enter the gulf. I was then but a boy. A few years later, after this, my father and mother removed to Farmington, and there I saw that man. I knew the moment I saw him. Within a few years afterward, he was taken sick and died. When his coffin was being lowered into the grave, my dream came to me, and I remembered that he had died in the dream. That evening, his son-in-law found $100,000 in a cellar belonging to the old man. I name this merely to show that in this dream, I had manifested to me certain things that were true, and I think of all the inhabitants of the world having to leave their goods when they come to the grave. Then he talks in this discourse about various other dreams he had and their meanings to him. Plainly, it was very important to him. Why do revelation and enlightenment appear to be associated on some occasions with states of reduced active consciousness? I'd like to turn to studies of consciousness for a moment. William James said the following, our normal waking consciousness, rational consciousness as we call it, is but one special type of consciousness, whilst all about it, parted from it by the filmiest of screens, there lie potential forms of consciousness entirely different. We may go through life without suspecting their existence, but apply the requisite stimulus, and at a touch, they are there in all completeness. Definite types of mentality which probably somewhere have their field of application and adaptation. I'm trying to decide whether to take a break here, and when I discussed this idea of altered states being useful with people who are close to me, often they'll say, what is the point? What is the point of pursuing this? It's so far out of our experience. Why would we want to even look this direction? What comes to me is the fact that we all experience sleep. Have you ever wondered why, for our mind's sake, it's important for us to experience sleep? How much of your time does it occupy? We learn about it as children that sleep is for our physical health, but it's also for our mental health. Okay, back to what I'm talking about, and I'll bring this back in. No account of the universe, this is William James still, in its totality can be final. No account of the universe in its totality can be final, which leaves these other forms of consciousness quite disregarded. How to regard them is the question, for they are so discontinuous with ordinary consciousness. With this statement, William James, who was an early 20th century psychologist and philosopher, address the phenomenon that a normal state of consciousness may not be the only medium by which we can appropriately apprehend the larger world around us. James further argued that although people in the ordinary waking state are certain that such a state is the sine qua non of reality, an equivalent certainty exists with persons who demonstrate altered states of consciousness. What is an altered state of consciousness? The current definition from the American Psychological Association is circular. A qualitative alteration in the overall pattern of mental functioning such that the experiencer feels of his or her consciousness to be radically different from the normal way it functions. That's it. An altered state is a state that feels qualitatively different from your normal state. Sleep is an altered state we experience regularly. You can recognize when you're asleep and when you're not. Sometimes you can even say to yourself, I'm asleep, because you know that you're asleep. Sometimes someone will ask if you're asleep and you say that you're not, but they know that you are. You experience that too. It is universally recognized that during sleep, our mental functioning is altered in such a way that our consciousness is radically different from the normal way it functions. It is also routinely a subject of our conversation. We talk about this altered state regularly. We say, we predict how much we'll experience tonight, how much we got last night, and if we're going to get enough. When we're deprived of this altered state of consciousness, we show predictable signs of distress and a markedly reduced ability to cope with our waking consciousness. Some other altered states are also fairly easy to recognize, a coma or a grand mal seizure, and some may be less easy to recognize. Our discussion today led off with reports of persons in Scripture and in Latter-day Revelation who experienced something meaningful, enlightenment, revelation, a peak experience, during what was probably an altered state, a state that felt qualitatively different from how the mind normally functions. There are two problems with this discussion. First, there is no reliable method by which to gather physiological information about an altered state from any of those experiences we started with. They already occurred. No measurement can happen. I suppose most of us have wondered whether a vision which was reported to us by someone else was real, in that it would make sense in our own model of reality. Second, there is ambiguity in the assessment of what personal revelation is meaning and what is not. How many of us have vacillated on whether one of our own dreams was meaningful or should be taken to mean anything at all? Notwithstanding these limitations, it is useful to look at subjective reports of meaningful experiences of receiving personal revelation which may have involved altered states. We can look for clues about those altered states in the reports themselves, and perhaps deduce conclusions about the connection between altered states and meaningful experiences. To address the concept of meaningfulness, I've taken as my guide John Curtis Gowan's description of mind-expanding experience. He identified characteristics common to mind-expanding experience as they often have an uncanny, supernormal quality. 2, they involve euphoria or bliss to an extent unknown in most of our usual activities. 3, they seem to be important in some strange way. 4, there's some element of dissociation. And 5, they remain in our memory longer and more vividly than ordinary events. How are altered states measured? T.X. Barber divides those who experience altered states into 3 categories. Individuals who are fantasy prone and have the ability to imagine vividly. 2, dissociators, those who separate the psyche as a defense mechanism against specific anxiety-provoking thoughts, emotions, and physical sensations. So we have fantasy prone and we have dissociators. The third category of those who experience altered states are those who are highly motivated individuals who appear to respond in a relatively conscious, goal-driven manner to hypnosis suggestion. That's the third category of people who experience altered states easily. While Barber established this division for his discussion of hypnosis, the same framework helps us appreciate that altered states of other kinds may be experienced by persons who are otherwise well-grounded, as opposed to some models which reduce the experience of altered states other than sleep to the province of mental illness and schizophrenia, the excessively fantasy-prone, or to drug use. This audience may be familiar with the EEG, or electroencephalogram, as a tool for the assessment of electrical activity in the brain. But a brief review may be helpful. By means of electrodes placed on the surface or just under the surface of the scalp, the brain's electrical activity is recorded and measured. Historically, 4 major types of brain waves are recognized, which have been designated as alpha, beta, theta, and delta. These types or states appear to correspond well with gross physiological descriptions which are pertinent to our discussion, such as waking and sleeping. The beta state, or more precisely, the state corresponding to brain electrical activity in the frequency range of 12 to 14 cycles per second up to about 35 cycles per second, is associated with our daily consciousness, physical activity, and active concentration. The alpha state, the state corresponding to brain electrical activity in the frequency range from 8 to 12 cycles per second, is associated with relaxation, closed eyes, and light states of meditation. Sitting in this session, for example, you're probably more in an alpha state than a beta state. The theta state, corresponding to brain electrical activity in the frequency range of 4 to 8 cycles per second, is seen in periods of drowsiness, daydreaming, lucid dreaming, trance states, light sleep, and in the preconscious state just prior to and just upon waking and just prior to sleeping. The delta state, up to 4 cycles per second, is associated with deeper sleep. In a typical day, you may move from the beta state, where you have probably spent most of your time, toward the alpha state as you relax, listen to music, or zone out. You may also trigger a move from beta to alpha as you meditate or pray. Thereafter, as you lie in bed with your eyes closed, you typically move imperceptibly from alpha to delta. As you fall asleep, from alpha to theta as you fall asleep, and then delta is the deepest sleep. REM sleep, you may be wondering, is a distinct stage of sleep which produces a pattern that has a background of theta activity showing additional activity in the alpha and beta ranges, which are higher. Beta ranges don't often come in during sleep except during the REM sleep stages. Strictly speaking, then, an altered state is one in which an EEG detects activity in the alpha, theta, and delta ranges while you are otherwise not sleeping. These feel subjectively different from our normal waking beta range consciousness. We may conclude then that since dreams of all types occur when brain activity slows down, that revelation received that feels like a dream may also be received during the time when our brain activity has slowed down. Can enhancing our experience of alpha and theta ranges actually increase our ability to receive revelation? That is the question. In a 1968 issue of Psychology Today, a Dr. Joe Kamaya reported he'd been training patients to produce an alpha state at will using a biofeedback machine. His purpose in doing so was to help them achieve tranquility. What he discovered was that by learning to voluntarily enter an alpha state, patients who had never previously been meditators were achieving a brain pattern similar to that found in 20-year practitioners of yoga, Zen, Sufis, and transcendental meditation. What is the connection between meditation and revelation? Joseph Smith records that during his vision of the celestial kingdom, it was received while we meditated, explaining that during the meditation, the Lord touched the eyes of our understandings, and they were opened, and the glory of the Lord shone round about. Joseph F. Smith recorded his meditation that led to what we understand as Section 138. In the teachings of Harold B. Lee, the book that we recently studied in Priesthood and Relief Society, David O. McKay is quoted advising, "He would arise at 5 o'clock in the morning when my mind and spirit are clear and rested, and then I meditate. You come closer to the Lord than you imagine when you meditate." Harold B. Lee went on about President McKay's instructions about meditation. He also told a story about a mother who received a visit from her dead child, and the father could not be contacted because he was too occupied, which we may understand as he kept his mind and brain activity in a higher beta state, more active beta state, and the mother, who was relaxing when this happened, was open to this revelation. President Lee summarized, "Don't get so busy that you don't have time to meditate. Christ may be nearer than we have knowledge." He said, "When we are relaxed in a private room, we are more susceptible to these things." My paper also has several experiences of Joseph Smith's meditation, and then the people with him were privileged to see the Father and the Son. I'm not going to take time to read them because my time is growing short, but this was his method as well. He would invite people to prepare and then to pray and to meditate, and then he would tell them that the time was approaching when they would have a vision, and then they did. I'm suspecting he had a sense of when that alpha, theta, and moving into the theta states occurred. The most interesting things are what's been happening with biofeedback and what kind of brain activity is being recorded as people are becoming more proficient at entering and staying in these states. And maybe I'll have a chance to share some of that research with you during the question and answer period. Let me finish this so that we can hear from our respondent who has some excellent things to say. The effect of fasting on brain waves was the subject of a study by Jay Suzuki and his colleagues. Suzuki noted that fasting patients experienced a slowing and synchronization of alpha waves, together with an increased incidence of theta waves, a combination of brain activity recorded in Zen meditations by Kasamatsu and Hirai. This suggests that fasting contributes to achieving an altered state, which may be conducive to receiving revelation, attunement, and enlightenment. In both formal and informal LDS discourse, it is typical to hear the observation expressed that experiences of enlightenment and revelation are inextricably connected with exactness in keeping the commandments of God. While there are surely rewards for obedience to true principles, my experience with clients in hypnotherapy and anecdotal evidence gathered by others suggests to me that a person at virtually any stage or level of development can have an altered state, spiritually meaningful experience. One legacy of Joseph Smith Jr., which stands as a gem in LDS theology, passed over by many, is that as sons and daughters of God, we are encouraged to seek revelatory experience. We do not passively wait and wonder whether we will be selected to receive manifestations which may be meaningful to us. We pursue them, as did Joseph Smith and others. Learning voluntary control of the brain's electrical activity to achieve specific patterns may prove to be as useful in experiencing enlightenment as any other more traditionally spiritual discipline. Perhaps in this way, God is waiting to speak more regularly and intimately with each of us, if we dare. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks to Lisa for presenting an excellent overview of why Latter-day Saints and others, including myself, might strive for personal revelation and what types of brain activity and altered states of consciousness are conducive to such spiritual openings. I'll note a few things based on an earlier draft of Lisa's paper, and I note, you know, one thing as I go through these notes that I've made, there, you know, I've kind of maybe focused more on peak experiences rather than those ongoing meditative prayerful states. So I'm still going to go through my notes, but I do notice kind of a different, flavor maybe than where I was going, but I think it'll still be useful. Will Binion wrote, "I believe Joseph Smith entered the sacred grove and found his God and built a very close and wonderful relationship with him. Latter-day Saints often feel they know about God through Joseph Smith. But to really know God, each must find our own sacred grove." And I think part of what I see in well, all culture, we have experience, we have an experience, and then we have our explanation of the experience, and then we have what we're supposed to believe about that experience, and it gets more in the way as we go along. And I think what Lisa's talking about is coming back to that regular, you know, meditative, that state, to just let that experience of God's goodness be with us. A question that I was presented with by Dan Weatherspoon when he asked me to respond to Lisa's paper was, how do we know if our peak spiritual experiences are literally real? How do we evaluate these experiences? My answer would be similar to my answer to a similar question regarding memory at last year's symposium. The short answer is that we don't know that an altered state experience is literally, concretely real unless it can be externally verified. But it can be very useful to our growth and integration regardless. In an essay entitled Why I Am a Believer, LDS historian Leonard Arrington wrote, "Because of my introduction to the concept of symbolism as a means of expressing religious truth, I was never preoccupied with the question of the historicity of the first vision, though evidence is overwhelming that it did occur, or many of the other reported epiphanies in Mormon, Christian, and Hebrew history. I am prepared to accept them as historical, or as metaphysical, or as symbolical, or as precisely what happened. that they convey religious truth is the essential issue, and of this I have never had any doubt. An example I used last year is also pertinent to how we can use altered state experiences to facilitate our growth, even while questioning the literal reality of our experience. During my training in hypnosis, a classmate was hypnotically regressed in an attempt to discover reasons for a long-term debilitating neck ache that occurred in stressful situations. He was regressed to an age as a young boy when he had a strongly emotional, detailed recollection of being smothered with a pillow almost to the point of death by an older brother. Randall Churchill, the practitioner, took great care to not suggest any scenario to my classmate, although those of us observing considered that the memory seemed so real that they must be literally true. Randall set aside the question of whether they were literally true until a later time when they might be verified. He instead worked with my classmate and his memories at a symbolic level, using Gestalt techniques to dialogue with various characters and parts of his experience. We witnessed quite a transformation and healing during this less than 2-hour period. In general, what I see with altered state cosmic consciousness raising states is that they're beneficial as they augment regular practices before and after, which lead to our integration and growth, which for me means growing in accepting and giving love. Philosopher Ken Wilber has some useful insights on altered states experiences. He notes that our development unfolds in sequential stages. He says that a peak, P-E-A-K, experience is often a peak, P-E-E-P-E-E-K, if I have the right number of E's right, a glimpse into a world up ahead in our development. He says, you can have a very powerful peak experience, but then days, weeks, months later, where do you carry it? What happens to this experience? Your actual self, your center of gravity, can only accommodate this experience according to its own stage of growth. Spiritual experiences do not allow you to simply bypass the growth and development upon which enduring spiritual realization itself depends. Perhaps Jesus is referring to something similar to this in the parable of the sower in Matthew 13. The seed sown on rocky ground stands for the man who, on hearing the word, accepts it at once with joy, but as it strikes no root in him, has no staying power. Wilber suggests that for true long-term spiritual growth, we practice a set of what he calls integral practices, practices such as meditation, movement, and exercise, that regularly stretch and integrate our bodies, minds, and spirits. Wilber and others say that peak experiences can actually hinder spiritual growth when they become the end in themselves. If, instead of giving thanks for our peak into a higher level, and then using its inspiration for continuing with our practices, and instead begin searching for more peak experiences, more highs, we can become much like the drug addict, continually searching for a similar or better high. For myself, I now view my peak spiritual experiences as moments of grace. My job is to be a good steward of those experiences by developing regular practices. An example. A retreat I go to yearly, near Mount Shasta, but there are over 100 worldwide, is actually a week-long daily set of Christian-based integral practices. It's called Camp Farthest Out. Let's call it CFO for short. It was founded in 1930 by a man named Glenn Clark. To my non-Mormon friends, I'll talk about Lil Binion saying, well, he's like the Mormon Glenn Clark. So I guess that would make Glenn Clark the non-Mormon Lil Binion. But there's a lot of similarities, and they were around at the same time teaching different universities. And he would also rise every morning at 4 a.m., and that was a regular practice of his. Anyway, CFO is a laboratory where he devised a laboratory, a camp, where all could look to where Jesus pointed to practice in body, mind, and spirit what Jesus taught about how to live love and pray rather than arguing about what we believe about it. Daily schedule involves meditation, singing, a speaker sharing a journey, their journey over the course of a week, movement, creative art, and prayer groups. I see this variety of practices alternating the inner, like meditation, and the outer, such as movement. It allows over the days to let God sneak in past our conscious minds, opening our hearts to His grace and love. 1 year I was a camp chairperson, a year when everything was going wrong, water off, bathrooms out, barren camp. Barely able to keep the camp physically running, I wondered whether there was any possibility of spiritual opening for myself, and wondered actually if I would ever return. I doubted myself and God, and even asked myself if I had invented or imagined God's presence in the past. But still I went to the daily schedule of practices, partly because I should as camp chairperson. My major prayer in my ongoing prayer group, small group, was to know in my heart, like my wife Shannon did, that we should have a baby. Near the end of camp, I stepped late into a circle dance in the movement section we call rhythms. As we sang Waters of Babylon, I bent down and looked into little five-year-old Rachel's eyes. It was like the clouds parted and I could see into heaven as God answered my prayer about the baby. Tears streamed. Besides the answer about having the baby, for the last 2 days of camp, my responsibilities flowed so easily, like magic. But in the following years, as we didn't get pregnant, I began to bring the same prayer to camp, to my prayer groups. And the answer that came so clearly was, God gave you a dramatic answer to your prayer. Be grateful and use it. I often think of the parable of the talents in Matthew 25. Jesus commands a servant who uses, grows, and multiplies what he is given. The servant who played it safe, banking or hiding what they were given, have not progressed in the opportunity given to them. I would submit that those who play it safe, to use again the words of Lowell Binion, often feel they know about God through Joseph Smith or somebody else, just some other person. But to really know God, each must find our own sacred grove. Thank you.
Please feel free to come to the aisle microphone to ask a question or make a comment. Thank you.
When Joseph Smith said that no man could see God with his natural eyes, is he really talking about a altered state or his physical eyes?
I don't know. It's possible to see it either way. What do you think?
I would think it would be altered state. Which God? Which part of God?
He answered, he thinks it's an altered state in another. I'm just saying this for the tape, for the benefit of the tape. Then we have an audience member who says, which God, which, what was the next part?
Which part of the body of God?
It gets rather complicated. I assume Joseph Smith meant that it's not something that you just walk into the other room and there God is. There's something that has to transform you. And that's a good question. Yes.
It seems like this whole issue is fraught with all kinds of problems, I guess. It seems today the church leaders would much rather us be obedient, maybe, than seek personal revelation. For example, you know, I guess when I ask questions about the relationship of blacks or gays or women to the church, I get the wrong answer, I guess. And so...
Well, they tell you asking the wrong question.
Well, maybe so. And I guess... When I was young, about 45 years ago, I went to a state conference and Richard L. Evans was speaking, and because he was a very famous person at the time and we were living out in the mission field, my parents brought a lot of their friends, and during the middle of his speech, a lady stood up and said, I see a halo around his head, you know, I know he's a prophet of God, and they carried her out, I guess. And I think people probably got the wrong idea of maybe what most of our ceremonies are like. But it seems to me like if everybody's out there getting personal revelation, you have a rough time running a church. And anyway, I just wondered...
It's a recipe for chaos.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I just wonder how all this fits together with the organized church.
It never will. I don't know exactly how individual variation works in any organization. It's always a problematic tension, isn't it? But I understood in the first thing you said, that yearning for a response to your own questions and a yearning for that a recognition of personal revelation, even in the questions that you're asking. So I think we all share that.
Anyway, so you're saying there's really no answer. We still need to look. But
well, it's the very same tension that exists in any question or conflict between people and their perceptions and points of view.
Well, it only is if you're encouraging personal revelation as well as a strong structural organization.
Well, right. That's right. That's true. And that's the tension that exists in our church.
Thanks.
Yes.
Well, the one thing, at least as I look at it, with Joseph Smith, with his revelations, with his altered states of consciousness, you really had some really, what you call, paradigm shifts. And I don't think, you know, in the structure, in general mainstream structure, paradigm shifts would be particularly appreciated most of the time. But, and I was saying this in the workshop yesterday, in anything, it's not just the LDS, you know, LDS church, you have, you know, the experience, say, of Joseph Smith, and you have the organism that grows naturally around that, the organism. And then in anything, any organism, you then begin to need an organization to keep it going. And part of that, you know, part of the whole basis for any organization and bureaucracy, it becomes to maintain itself besides the original, you know, its original intent to hold, you know, to be a container for that experience, for that organism. So I really feel both. I mean, I've always, you know, I can see it so clearly maybe in the LDS culture rather than other places because it is pretty dramatic. But I really respect those people that somehow seem to balance that, and I can see how it can be a hard balance, but you really have the organism, you have the organization, and it's a juggling act as I see it.
I've been trying to make this question make sense. Both of you brought up interpretation of a revelatory experience or a spiritual experience. And I'm thinking about the danger of various interpretations. Lisa, you sort of told us, well, since Joseph Smith had revelations, it's okay for us to also. But if I don't weigh the consequences of some of his revelations, then does that mean that my revelations could have adverse consequences as well? And how do I interpret what the spiritual experiences I have, what they mean? And it seems like whenever you have a spiritual experience that affects someone else, then that's where it gets to be dangerous. The interpretation could really be maybe taking advantage of someone.
Hence that old favorite dream and vision of young men at BYU. Beware the man who tells you he had a dream. Exactly. Well, and do it's not fiction, dear. I suspect you received your share as well. Oh yes, okay. Well, and can true revelations contradict one another? That's the question. And is there ever really a definitive interpretation of what a revelation means? If you have had revelation in your own life, or even a manifestation or a vision, you recognize that as time goes on, you look at it very differently. It may mean something to you at the time that it happens. Years later, it may mean exactly the opposite. And if that's true with one experience over time, it can't help but be the same, two individuals receiving a revelation at the same time may find that to mean something very different. Never ceases to amaze me that God apparently allows us to interpret revelation in the way we see fit, and to let us live by it and create our lives around it, and then see what's been created. That's a good tension observation as well.
We had a family reunion. My great-grandma said, "Oh, that's the ones I dreamed about. I better go see them." She did. They converted to the gospel. We just have story after story after story of them being led where they want to go. Usually they were praying people, whether they were, had heard the restored gospel or not, they were praying people. My Dutch grandparents, they had a dry goods store in Amsterdam, and so my grandma was praying one night. My son, my father, is a genius, and to run a dry goods store is not enough. What shall I do? So that night, the dry goods store burned to the ground. So she said, "Start packing. We're going to America." My grandpa said, "I'm not going to America." She said, "Yes, you are." And then in the home, Dutch women have the last say. So they packed, and they came to America.
What country was that?
Well, they're just very strong,
tough women. What country was that where women have the last word?
Well, everybody agrees that in the home, the woman's in charge in that culture. So they came to America, and Nicholas G. Smith, that had been trying to get in to talk to him, and nope, we don't want to hear about an American cult. He was standing in the middle of the street when they came in to Salt Lake. And they came there because they knew only one person in America who was in Salt Lake. And he was standing in the middle of the street, and he got them an apartment, and he took stuff from his vegetable store over and got them set up and taught them the gospel, and they joined the church. We have numerous things like that. I personally used to be scared to death of my ancestors who said, "Well, I saw so-and-so who's dead, and I had a visit from so-and-so." I said, "Oh, I don't want that to happen to me. That's just too scary." Well, my son, who is dead of cancer, 1 year after his burial date, visited me. And he was well again, and he kissed me, and I could feel it. And I was happy to see that he was well and strong and marvelously happy. And I never grieved about him since. So there are messages given through these things.
I'm just wondering, Lisa and Les, if in your professional work with hypnotherapy or hypnosis, if you attempt to assist people in having peak experiences or spiritual openings, and if you do, if you could just talk about that a little bit.
I would say that's probably the main point of what I hope to accomplish, but I think it has very little to do with what I hope to accomplish. When I work with someone, often it's the people who want it the most who don't get it. I'm not sure why that is, where those who come out of curiosity end up having the peak experience. I've never quite understood that. So, yes and no.
Well, last year I went through 4 levels of training, and I'm certified in hypnotherapy. I'm not practicing. I'm actually going through a master's level right now. And I would say what's good for me, what was really good in my training, is that it kept coming back to something very simple. For me, with hypnosis, you know, hypnotherapy, it's very similar, at least as I interpret it, to meditation and prayer. Seeing the induction phase of hypnosis as meditation, and then the, you know, suggestion and after that, as prayer. And so what was in my training, what was reinforced is just keeping it simple, helping people relax, relax, reduce stress, and open themselves to where they need to go now. And some people do have quite an idea of where they want to go, and sometimes they do go there, and sometimes they don't, in my experience. Anyway, the short answer is I don't use it that way, but I've seen dramatic, like the experience that I was telling about, quite dramatic, but just creating an opening for that to be there. That's what I see with the experience with my classmate and what I've seen with other things related. Creating an opening for that to be there and then working with it, symbolically. So it's real. You know, healing is going on within, regardless of whether literally this guy was smothered by the pillow when he was young or not. Something happened and he was working through it on some level. So I see it more as openings.
With this regard to those wanting it don't get it as much, is there something about being fixed on a certain outcome that closes off, opens to revelation, whereas just going into what comes to me in an open way allows for more revelation?
Well, that would make sense. I'm not sure that's the whole story. I think those of us who want it spend more time perhaps studying about it and are aware of many different things about it. And then when we have the experience, it rests in the intellectual part of our mind and doesn't flower in the other parts of our minds. That's my guess. How to stay out of the analytical part of the mind is more difficult if you've been pursuing it analytically. That's my guess. Yes?
But remember the three types that you talked about.
The three types.
The third type is the type that's motivated and knows what that individual wants to go.
And
for.
That's true. That she's saying that the third type is the person who is goal-driven and who follows the hypnotic suggestion and can also experience the altered state. That is true. But that also involves following the hypnotic suggestion in a way that stays out of that analytical state. And I know from experience, when you follow hypnotic suggestion, you can follow it on many levels. Your conscious mind can be following it, your subconscious mind can be following it, and one can gradually take over the other. You can still be in this, the beta consciousness, fighting for control over what's happening and trying to analyze it as it's going, and that is a significant block to letting go as well.
Hi. Would you consider a near-death experience to fall into the altered states category?
That's a good question. On an EEG, people who experience near-death experience have a very different brainwave pattern. Flat. And so I imagine it feels qualitatively different, yes.
Not with that definition, though. I mean, okay, you were talking about people who have this as a goal, who want to attain an altered state of consciousness or something like that. Well, I have those all the time. It's no big deal to me. But what I really want is a near-death experience. Not that I want to die, but I want that. I've almost drowned on numerous occasions, but never had near-death experience. And I feel cheated because I really wanted one of those. I have read about people who have had them, and they have a totally different perspective of their life and what things mean in their lives. Do you have anything to say about that?
Oh, I have lots to say about it. I think there isn't a single one of us that wouldn't want to have the kind of experience where we actually get a chance to go back, see what life is like in the spirit world, get that changed sense of what everything in our life means, what the significance is, what our mission's really all about, and then come back. And the idea that people can have this just by almost drowning or just by almost dying seems so unfair. When people like you and like me and like lots of other people would be willing to go through that just for that because it would change everything else. That's one thing that inspired me to pursue hypnotherapy. I could not imagine that life was so arbitrary that only those who physically put themselves in some kind of danger or were exposed to danger were allowed that kind of life-transforming experience. I believe that it's available and that it's simply a matter of pursuing it.
So do you feel like your hypnotherapy helped you have that same kind of perspective?
Yes. She asked if I feel that hypnotherapy gives that same kind of perspective. Absolutely. And from the reports of some of the clients, yes. Absolutely. Yes, Les. And then our erstwhile murderer here.
I wanted to give her the blessing.
and I would say yes, and it's kind of the razor's edge with kind of John's question. It's really in hypnotherapy as I've experienced. It's not like I'm going to give you this experience, but it's like working with those parts of you, opening it up, that possibility is there, opening up and working with those parts of you that want that experience, why and all. And there's different ways. I mean, I saw that in John Kessler's workshop, this big mind process, I think works in ways with that psychosynthesis process that I've worked with as a part of my training works with it. And for me, it really does. Wanting something is the kiss of death for me, with my conscious mind. That's why the CFO camp, where you're doing these different practices regularly, some that you don't want to be at, but this inner, this outer balance, just going through it daily, hourly, it just kind of finally slips in underneath my conscious mind so God can get in. That's kind of how I see it.
I was thinking the words of Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, eye hath not seen, nor hath ear heard the things which God has prepared for those that love him. Is he really saying that there's just stuff hidden out there, and when he shows it to us with the same eyes and the same ears, we're going to be able to see that? That seems hard to believe. What we assume, our waking state of consciousness is what we normally assume as reality, but we know there are animals that see better than we do, that see a broader range, that have a greater range of the smell or a greater range of hearing. So it's obvious that the waking state of consciousness tells us more about the perceptual apparatus of the perceiver than the state of what's being perceived, the reality of what's being perceived. So I would have to say that higher states of consciousness, altered states of consciousness, are really going to be essential for us to ultimately see the full reality as it is and to ultimately see and experience the things of God in their fullness.
Two questions. Given the problems with revelation, namely ambiguity of meaning and the inability of the experiencer to integrate the meaning into his or her life beyond his or her present spiritual development, is there too much emphasis being put on the importance of pursuing these revelatory experiences, do you think? I have another question. In light of your comments about the ability of the mind to pursue hypnotic suggestions at multiple levels, would you still hold to your statement that we need to get out of the analytical state in order to get into the altered state, or is it more correct to say that we need to be in an integrated state in which the mind pursues at both the analytical and non-analytical level.
I'm sorry, we are out of time.
That's stuff I want to get into. Maybe next year. That's exactly what I want to get into.
Thank you for coming today. Appreciate your, all your participation. Thank you.